Hello there, welcome to the latest Convex Conversation with me, journalist Helen Fospero. One of my favourite jobs is appearing as a guest in Dictionary Corner on Countdown with resident etymologist and lexicologist Susie Dent. Susie has been explaining the origins and meanings of words to viewers for more than 25 years on Channel 4, and she's a much-loved part of the team on Jimmy Carr's naughty version, 8 out of 10 Cats. She's recently launched her own podcast series with the wonderful Giles Brandreth. She's been doing one-woman tours and is helping the nation get to grips with spelling. Susie, it's so lovely to have a bit of time to chat, as it's always such a rush in between filming, isn't it?
I know. I think a lot of people perhaps don't realise that we do 5 shows a day. So it's a really quick turnaround. We've kind of got it down to a fine art now. It's been going for so long. And as you say, there isn't that much time to chat because we have to change. At least we only have to change our tops. Rachel Riley has to change her bottoms as well. So we're not, you know, I think we come off lightly.
So I'm fascinated to hear about those tours you've been doing, The Secret Lives of Words. What was the idea behind it and what's it been like?
It's funny, just listening to you there in your introduction, for which thank you, saying a one-woman tour. And I just thought, me? Really? It sounds so unlikely, even now. It's essentially, as you can imagine, it's about words, inevitably. But it's a wonderful thing and has been a wonderful thing for me because everybody who comes knows what to expect and they are clearly passionate about words. So if you like, they're already on side. They've come to hear about the joy of words. And the atmosphere is really hard to describe, Helen, but they are so positive and so receptive and so happy to laugh and smile. And, you know, it isn't as much about me. It is about the words. And the tour is called The Secret Lives of Words. So I'm kind of delving into the unexpected, if you like, and all the strange, I hesitate to use the word journey because everybody uses it these days, but they are journeys, these travelogues that each word has had that you can find in the dictionary. So I've absolutely loved it. And as you can imagine too, it's a much more intimate experience because, you know, you have your audience right there and then you can see them and you can laugh with them and have fun with them. And I have a word surgery at the end where they can ask anything they want within reason.
Were you nervous the first time you got out there on stage and doing it? Because it's very different to being in a TV studio, isn't it? Surrounded by people you work with all the time.
Very different. On Countdown, obviously, the people that I work with for a very long time, and likewise the camera crew, as you will know, are also old-timers along with me. So that is very different. Was I nervous? I was genuinely petrified. You mentioned just before we started recording, actually, that you'd seen the first episode of Countdown, which I'm sure we'll talk about. But that did the look of sheer horror on my face, which is still unfortunately evidenced on YouTube, was pretty much what I felt that first night in Ilkley, which is where I launched the tour. But honestly, within 5 minutes, the audience laughed at something I said, and that was it. I just thought, do you know what? I'm going to love this. And I have done ever since.
It must be lovely for you as somebody who's so passionate about words. I'm passionate about words, actually. I mean, obviously not in the same way or in the same detail as you are, but I feel I'd love to have been a wordsmith. But it must be great that you're sitting there and as a nation, we seem as fascinated by words, really, as we are the weather.
Totally true. I think, you know, if you use the word lexicographer, you know, most people will think, well, what on earth is that? And it sounds like the dullest job in the world. But I promise you, it is absolutely the best gig. So when I'm not doing Countdown, you will find me almost invariably in front of the Oxford English Dictionary. And I genuinely discover something new there every single day. And you're right. You know, if you ask somebody, what's your favourite word or what's your least favourite word, you'll get that same kind of ignition of excitement as you will get if you ask them their favourite kids' TV programme, you know, as they were growing up. We all have our pet hates and we all have our loves, and it's a genuine conversation starter, and you will be talking for a long time after.
Oh, I'm definitely going to ask you some of your favourite words and least favourite words later. But just explain, you mentioned lexicographer there, which is what you are, and an etymologist. Let's get this straight. What are both?
I sometimes really struggle with the language of lexicography, which is essentially, in its strictest sense, compiling dictionaries. But it also encompasses, you know, working with language, being interested in linguistics, being involved with dictionaries. boundaries. And the etymological side of things, which again is another tricky word, is simply being a word detective. So etymologists will look at the history of a word from its earliest meaning, perhaps in Anglo-Saxon times, right up until the present day. And historical dictionaries like the OED aren't purely historical. So then they don't stop at some point in the past. The work on them is going on and on and on via an amazing team based at Oxford University Press. And, you know, there's a real buzz in the offices as well. You know, if they discover an earlier date for a word, you know, I remember the excitement when we discovered an earlier date for bad hair day, which we thought was kind of, you know, 1990s. And I think we antedated it, as we say, by just a few decades, but we were still really excited about it. So it's the best job in the world.
And an etymologist, is that somebody who is the word detective, basically?
Exactly. That's when we dig for evidence of how a word was created. If we're lucky, we might get the first record of a word, but that is so hard to find, you know, especially now, if you think about it, somebody online might use the word, I don't know, whoever first flipped sick to mean lovely or great or fantastic, excellent, in kind of teen slang, wouldn't it be wonderful to find the first person? But that is almost impossible now, given the internet. But there are occasions in the past where you can find the exact moment that a phrase or word was born, like stealing someone's thunder, which I can tell you about. And the excitement is just amazing because it's so rare to find the single hand that created something.
What is stealing someone's thunder?
Oh, it's just, it's one of those stories that you might have heard, if anyone remembers Call My Bluff, which was a quiz show from a few decades ago.
Oh, I remember that.
It had a few hosts and it was a brilliant show. Essentially, people would give false but entirely plausible histories for particular words and phrases or meanings for specific terms. And this one sounds like it's been invented, but it really wasn't. So stealing someone's thunder began in the early 18th century in London's Drury Lane Theatre. And there was a player manager, John Dennis, who was a playwright as well as a manager. And he wrote this pretty turgid play by all accounts, which went on. It didn't go down very well. It closed after a really short run, but it had one thing going for it. And that was the sound of thunder from a thunder making machine that he had invented, probably using kind of rolls of steel or something, you know, something that would replicate quite well the sound of thunder. And anyway, despite that, it closed. He was, by all accounts, quite a supportive person. He went along to the next production, which was Macbeth, and was sitting in the audience enjoying himself, by all accounts. And there are accounts, because people were sitting in the audience with him and wrote it up afterwards, because from the stage suddenly boomed the sound of thunder that reverberated around the theatre. And two people who were there at the time, two eyewitnesses, said he stood up and shouted, "Damn them, they will not let my play run, but they steal my thunder." And then it, you know, sneaked into the language, meaning to sort of, you know, steal someone's glory, essentially. But what a wonderful literal beginning.
Oh, it's a very, very lovely story. And Susie, where does your love of words come from in the first place?
I wish I had the answer to that, Helen, because I don't really. I know that I certainly didn't have a massive aptitude towards maths, was really not very good at geography, enjoyed the sciences a little bit. But when it came to words, there was just something really magical going on. They were genuinely my safe place, I think. So whenever I was feeling lost with friendships or, you know, home stuff, I would genuinely seek refuge in a vocabulary book. And I always tell the story of trying to decipher shampoo bottle ingredients when I was little in the bath, looking at other scripts and thinking, I know I won't be able to understand this, but someone on the other side of the world will, someone perhaps my age. And then just, yeah, they must have been the most boring ingredients in the world when you think about it, but I was fascinated by them.
And were some of them Arabic and Cyrillic?
Yeah, it must have been Cyrillic, Arabic, all sorts, plus, you know, incredibly long chemical formulae, probably. But for some reason, I found them fascinating. And then my first absolute loves were foreign languages. So French and German vocabulary books were my go-to reads in the back of the car. We used to go on really long trips down to the south coast, freezing in the winter. My dad loves the sea. And I never wanted to get out when I got there, not just because it was cold, but because I was lost in these books. And it was just for me, genuinely. It wasn't so I could get good marks at school. I just loved these foreign, exotic looking words.
And then, of course, you went on, you went to a convent school, actually, didn't you?
I did.
Was your love of languages encouraged there?
Yes, it was. During lockdown, I've been trying to learn Spanish, which is a massive gap. I really, really want to get to grips with Spanish, and Welsh is next on my list.
Welsh, wow.
Yes. And I was remembering how certain techniques just didn't work for me, or perhaps I was too young. So I remember really early on in primary school having a French teacher come in, and we had no French whatsoever, and just start talking to us in French. So it was a thoroughly immersive way of teaching. And because I couldn't see anything written down, I really struggled. And it was only later, when I actually could see the text, that I started to get to grips with it. And German was taught to me, fittingly, a lot of people would say, in a very logical way. And I started it at secondary school, and I was just, I think, really receptive to it. And it was immersive in some ways, but also entirely structured. And as I say, text-based. And that for me was the most important thing. And I fell in love with it there and then. I had a fantastic German teacher, Mrs. Briscoe, who was strict, but just, you know, inspired us. She just loved the German language. And to this day, despite what many people think, I feel that German is amongst the most beautiful languages of the world.
It's interesting you say that, because I was absolutely hopeless at German at school, and it was the only class that I was ever naughty in. And I think a lot is to do with the teacher. But also,
yes,
I found the language quite harsh, but you found real beauty not only in the normal language, but in German poetry, haven't you?
I love German poetry, yes, and I still will try and read it now. I used to try and translate them and then just realised it's completely hopeless. I'll never actually get, you know, get the sort of the full rhythm and the lyricism right. So I stopped there. But yes, Rilke, by all accounts, not the nicest of men, which was a real disappointment. But his poetry is so, yeah, I still dive into that occasionally today. But I do, yeah, I think it's, you know, English can also sound incredibly harsh and guttural. I think it just depends who is speaking it at the time. And obviously there are very sibilant languages like French and Spanish and Italian. There's Swiss German, which is kind of bouncy, as though you're sitting on the back of a cart. But I read something really interesting the other day, actually, which was from a 19th century sound symbolist, if that's a word. And he was looking at the different characteristics of different languages. And he said the languages of the south of the Mediterranean are kind of, if you listen, you can hear swaying palm trees and the buzzing of insects and the soft rippling of the ocean. Whereas for northern languages, including ours, you can hear, I think he said, crashing cataracts and cracking pines. And he was saying that they are much harsher, and that kind of reflects the harsher environment, which I thought was really interesting. But German, definitely, I think there is real beauty in there, and I would encourage anyone to explore it a bit.
You're talking to us today from your home in Oxfordshire, and you went to Oxford, didn't you, to study modern languages? I would imagine I wasn't bright enough to go anywhere like that, but there must have been a real magic to walking around the university, Susie.
There was. And, you know, like anybody and any student, I just didn't realise it at the time. I think, obviously, I could appreciate the beauty of buildings, but quite quickly, I just think I took it for granted. And, you know, I would, when you say, you know, you weren't bright enough, you absolutely were. I just became a real swot and a geek and a nerd quite quickly. Oh, there are differences between the three, I think, but, you know, so I worked incredibly hard, and it was a brilliant time for me. I have to say, I didn't study massively until my third and fourth years, but it was amazing. But it's really, you mentioned lockdown. During this time, you know, we've been allowed a little bit of exercise, and I every day I've been going for a bike ride around the old haunts, the old places I used to go to, which I've studiously resisted for so long because somehow I just felt like I would be overwhelmed a little bit. And I'm not sure I wanted all the memories to come back, or at least there might have been a real sense of loss. But, you know, it's been one of the most wonderful things. I feel like I've rediscovered Oxford in a way I couldn't have hoped for. So that, for me, for all its hardship, that's been the most positive benefit of lockdown.
And it must have been incredible when you finished your studies. I know you did German at Princeton in America, but to work for Oxford University Press, because presumably that meant your head was in a dictionary most of the day.
Yes, it did. It's funny because I came back from Princeton, had no idea what I was going to do. Like many dreamers, I thought, I love books. I want to work with books. And I had also just found somewhere to live in Soho in London, which was just amazing, as you can imagine. It was a fair rented flat rented up by Westminster Council. And it was just the most buzzing, wonderful place to be. And then I got the job at OUP. And so I commuted for quite a long time. And it was great. And inevitably, I suppose, I was working on French and German bilingual dictionaries to begin with. So my whole experience, my whole immersion in English actually only came quite a bit later. It was definitely foreign languages for me until I was in my probably late 20s.
Now, you mentioned that I watched your first appearance in Dictionary Corner on YouTube. Yes. It was 1992 with that Rula Lenska with a massive hairdo.
Yes.
How did Countdown come about? And how do you look back on that first episode? You did look a bit nervous, to be honest, but I'm sure were.
I really was. And I'm glad, actually, that it came across as nerves, because whenever I look at it now, which is as little as I can, it kind of strikes me that I look really arrogant, and I'm always really worried that I might come across as being just sort of incredibly above it all. But, you know, I was terrified. Rula Lenska was wonderful. Richard and Carol were both incredibly generous, and, you know, they just kind of eased me along. It came about because Oxford University Press published the dictionary that is used on Countdown to this day. And then they also rented out, if you like, somebody who worked there and knew their way around a dictionary to the programme, to be the arbiter and referee on the show. And my boss, who was the marketing director, actually, he was my sort of main boss, he asked me if I would consider going on it. And I said no. This is, I think I'd only been there about 2 weeks. But he persisted and said, look, they're really looking for people. Why don't you just go up and give it a try? And I think after three attempts, I finally said yes, because he told me it would be very good for my job. So I had no choice, really. And thank God Simon did, because, you know, despite that first appearance, for some reason, they kept me on. And a lot of people will remember the days when actually we rotated. So I only went up, I guess, about two or three times a year before I went full time.
And I grew up on Richard Whiteley, actually, reading my local news. So I was a big Richard Whiteley fan.
Of course.
And Carol Vorderman was doing the maths in those days. What were they like to you? And were they very encouraging?
Yeah, they really were. I think being the sort of daydreamer I was and being probably quite introverted, I knew that the TV was not going to be my world. So I kind of feel like there must be people I was at school with who happened to put the TV on if they've not noticed it already and thought, oh my goodness, she's still on that show. She's not done very well for herself. But that was truly never my intention. It's just, you know me, Helen, it's not my absolute go-to world, much as I love it. And I have to say, I've just been so fortunate to have that gig. But, you know, I kind of felt slightly separate from that world, but they did pull me into it with open arms. And we used to all in those days go to a little room to have lunch in between the shows. And it was such a lovely thing. It was just like everybody let their guard down and we'd have a laugh. And if Richard was in a grump, we'd try and kind of cajole him out of it. And Carol was always laughing. So they were really special times, actually. And some of the team are still there today. Damien, our producer for one. You know, it's such a cliche when I suppose people say about their TV crews, oh, well, it feels like a family, but Countdown truly does.
And I know exactly what you mean when you say it's not very you, because whenever I come on, which is about once every 6 months, we always have a photograph and you're always going, oh, don't have a photo with me. Go and have it with Nick or Rachel. They like it better.
Yes.
You're still quite shy. And there's a real irony to that, given that you're in people's living rooms, you know, regularly and have been for the last 25 years. I actually love that you've... You know, you're still very true to who you are and it hasn't changed you in any way, shape or form.
Yes.
And of course, now it's hosted by lovely Nick Hewer.
It is.
Of The Apprentice fame. And I do adore Rachel Riley. I find it absolutely breathtaking watching her doing the math. She's extraordinary, isn't she?
She really is. And it's also that persistence that if she can't get a sum, you can see it will just eat away at her. She's ever so slightly distracted while she's still trying to work it out. This is on the rare occasion that she can't get it during the 30 seconds. And it really, really matters. And if on the even rarer occasion she can't get it in the course of the show, she will take it home with her until she does. So yes, she is amazing. Nick is lovely. One of the kindest people, actually, in the whole business. He's just very loyal and really looks out for people. I was laughing when you just mentioned photos, because I remember going up a red carpet with Carol and literally running in heels as fast as I possibly could to get past all the photographers. And Carol just suddenly, her whole body just relaxed and she could just do it in a way that I've never, ever been able to. So you're right. And Rachel's the same. I hate photos with a passion.
And do you have absolute moments when you just all corpse and have to keep doing retakes because something very funny happens?
Yes, it's usually because Rachel knows most things in the Urban Dictionary and Nick and I don't. Although Nick is very mischievous and he might cotton on to something that's a little bit rude and then probe me so that I kind of end up having to define something really awkwardly. Growler, I think, was one of them that came up. I don't know if you're familiar with this definition in the Urban Dictionary, but it came up. It's in the dictionary. And Nick said, "So what is a growler?" And I just said, "Well, it's a thing or person that growls." And meanwhile, Rachel, off to my right, was just bent over. I don't know how rude we can get on this, but you can edit this one out.
I don't know what growler means.
No, well, that's fine. But the other example I can think of was...
Oh, are you going to give us a clue? Give us a sort of clue.
It's part of the female anatomy, essentially.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Another even ruder one, but this is more for the kind of naughtier version of Countdown that you mentioned, Late Night Countdown. But I think it was the last show of the week. We were all quite tired, so I thought I might kind of put a bit of zing into proceedings by talking in my Origins of Wordsworth about the history of terms for underwear. And I was going through all the various, you know, knickers, camis, suspenders, that kind of thing. And then I finally got to teddy, the word teddy, which, you know, teddy, it's like a sort of loose kind of camisole type thing. And I looked directly...
I've had a teddy or two.
Good. I looked directly at Nick and I said, "Nick, I don't know if you've ever come across a teddy." I had Martin Lewis, who the money-saving expert, to my left as the guest. And I was aware of him shaking and then looked over to Rachel and she just couldn't keep it together at all. And do you know what? I honestly only realised what I'd said in the car on the way home. I couldn't quite work it out. So that kind of thing happens a lot.
I've been to a recording of 8 out of 10 cats and there must be moments when it's very difficult to hold it all together. I mean, you're there very much as stooges, aren't you? You and Rachel in a sort of straighter role.
Yes.
To some very funny people led by lovely Jimmy Carr.
Yes, we are stooges. And actually, I'm quite happy being there. Certainly, I felt I wasn't quite sure whether I was supposed to be funny. And I'm genuinely only ever funny by mistake. So if I find the audience laughing, I'm not completely sure why until I realise that actually I've said something quite witty, but I didn't really mean to. But I'm much happier being the straight person after all in the face of all the comedy, because I think that works quite well. And we're not comedians and we'll never be comedians, but we can just do our bit. And yes, our faces are genuinely aching by the end of the show. They're very long shows, so they usually are probably two and a half hours long and then edited back to 45 minutes.
They get you to do some funny things though, don't you? I remember when I was in the audience, you were pushing one of the comedians in a giant snowball across the studio. Are there ever times when they ask you to do things and you think, "Oh God, no, please, that's one step too far"?
Yeah, I'm usually game for certain things. But yes, if anything ever involves Joe Wilkinson, you can sort of bet that it's probably going to involve something pretty yucky.
Head was in a donkey on that particular show, but I don't think we should go there.
I remember one motorcycle stunt where they asked me quite casually if I'd come for a rehearsal and just said, "Well, just lie around there, just make sure you're within those 2 points." And then I had a motorcycle just leap over me. They were quite low, I have to say. But, you know, the instructions were there and I thought, okay, that's fine. But in the middle of a show, you know, when everything is, it was live in that we had a big audience watching this and there was only one take possible for this. And I suddenly realised, oh gosh, this is where I actually come on. So I kind of ran on to sort of saw the little strip of tape showing me where I needed to lie. But, you know, just hurriedly got down before this motorcycle came up. And apparently I didn't quite realise how close it got to my face. And everyone afterwards said, are you OK? I can't believe that. And I was thinking, yeah, I'm fine. But actually, when you look at it, it was pretty spooky. But yeah, I'm usually up for those sort of things.
You have this wonderful sort of brainy, you've mentioned the word swotty, nerdy image in the nicest way possible. But I wonder if public perception of you shifted a bit when you started to do 8 out of 10 cats.
I hope so, because I hope it, you know, just allows me to show a little bit more of me. I think generally people, you know, see me as being quite kind of demure. But some of that went out the window when I did a guide to swearing for the online site associated with Channel 4. And that was really fun. That was because I'm fascinated by swearing. It's one of the hottest topics in linguistics at the moment, and indeed in medicine. Lots of research going on into the physiological benefits of swearing. So that was a really fun thing to do. So I think that kind of opened a few eyes. My dad resolutely refuses to watch 8 out of 10 cats, but I did discover that my mum actually quite enjoys it. Very unexpected reactions from my parents. But yes, I mean, I think, you know, some people might feel I'm letting the side down. I just feel like I'm being more me, which is, you know, important sometimes.
What is the fascination with swearing? Is it the history or the taboos that have perhaps shifted over time? Or
yeah, both of those. I think, yes, our kind of shifting squeamishness is really interesting. So in the Middle Ages, it was all about religious blasphemy and profanity. That was the absolute no-no. So to be avoided at all costs was any mention of God or Jesus. And so all sorts of euphemisms crept in for that. Whereas what we consider to be very taboo these days was actually a little bit improper, maybe, but not entirely profane as we would see it today. I mean, profane actually comes from the Latin outs for outside the temple, so it's something that's not sacred. So the C word, you know, the biggest offender of the lot for us these days, that actually could be freely found in anatomy manuals in the Middle Ages and gynecology manuals, etc. And similarly, the F word was, you know, yes, perhaps a little bit improper, but definitely not obscene. So yeah, it's really interesting to see which way we are headed. And a lot of people will say, well, you know, everyone swears these days. What's really interesting for me, I think, is that they've seen off so many contenders over the centuries, and yet they still have power. And you only have to see on Cat or hear a comedian swear on Cat's Down to kind of hear that knee-jerk laughter from the audience. There's still something kind of naughty and quite powerful about it. And I mentioned that medical research. There have been lots of experiments showing that actually pain and frustration and stress can be released quite effectively through the use of swearing. You know, lots of experiments showing that and what it does to our brain. And also, fascinatingly, it's stored in a different place to other areas of our language. So when stroke patients, for example, start to recover language, quite often, even if they've not been swearers at all through their lifetime, they'll suddenly start swearing at their family, which of course is very shocking. But it's because it's been preserved in a separate part of their brain, and that's what they're recovering first. So the whole subject, I think, is utterly intriguing, and I would love to be around in 100 years to see where our swear words are and whether anything's replaced them.
I've picked three of my sort of favourite words, and I don't know whether you want to pick one of them or whether you can give me a summary of all of them, but I really love the word palpable.
Yes. Palpable is great. I wrote a piece actually for the iPaper the other day on the language of touch. We're now living at a time when, you know, touch can't be intuitive anymore. It's really carefully controlled. We can't even touch our own faces without potential risk. And it struck me just how much the thread of touch runs through our language and how much we reference things by degree of human contact. And when we talk about being touched, we talk about having feelings. And palpable is another word. It goes back to the Latin for touching. And it is something that is actually so strong in a way that it promotes or provokes a physical response in your body. It is, you know, tangible. Again, that's from another word meaning to touch. It's interesting because I looked in a historical thesaurus for synonyms for touch, and there are so few. It seems to encompass so many different things, and yet again we haven't really come up with many words to sort of sidestep it. It's that important. So I agree with you, palpable is really nice. And then in medical terms, people talk about palpating as well.
echo I like, and I think I like echo because it sounds like it means somehow in my head.
Yeah, echo goes back to Greek mythology, and echo was the name of a mountain nymph who was deprived of speech to stop her chattering, because apparently she liked to talk a lot, and she was left able only to repeat what others had said. And then she fell in love with Narcissus, the handsome Narcissus, and when he rejected her, she wasted away until there's nothing left of her but her voice.
Oh my goodness.
It's quite a sad story.
And then my other one I picked is actually I've stolen from you because I read your Twitter feed on a regular basis. So my new favourite word is lucifugal. I hope I pronounced that correctly.
Yes. Yes. That has lux, the Latin for light, in it. And lucifugal, it's usually used to describe nocturnal animals. So it means shunning the light or fleeing the light. Straight from Latin again. I mean, Latin just, you know, informs so much of our language and our vocabulary. But yes, shunning the light. And I think I used it on Twitter to describe somebody who peeks out from under the duvet and then probably goes back under.
I think that's all of us right now.
Yes.
Isn't it? Peeping out of the duvet and going straight back under.
Yes.
What words would you like to see back, Susie?
Well, I'm on a mission, as any regular followers of me on Twitter will know, to bring back the most beautiful word that has only one record in the Oxford English Dictionary, inexplicably, and that is apricity. And apricity is the warmth of the sun on a chilly day, which I just think is wonderful. Because, you know, we all know that sort of that sudden feeling of joy, really, when we just have the strength of the sun, even if it's frosty all around us. So I think that's beautiful. Another one that I love is scurry funging. Gosh, I mention this one a lot. To scurry funge, it's an American dialect word, so at least probably 150, 200 years old. And it means to rush around the house tidying up just before guests arrive. But I did wonder what the lockdown equivalent would be, because obviously we haven't got any visitors coming. And so a lot of us have taken to tidying up a lot or spring cleaning. And I just wondered if that was like a dawdle funge or something.
And what are your favourite words, Susie? I mean, you know the history and the meanings of so many. Are there one or two that really stand out for you that remain your favourite?
I think the one that I always mention is halcyon, just because, well, actually it's not just because, there are so many reasons. It sounds beautiful for a start. We talk about the halcyon days of summer or of our youth. So they're kind of long, beautiful days of serenity and happiness. But it's also attached to another lovely myth, which is the halcyon, which was the kingfisher, an old name for the kingfisher. And the legend had it that the kingfisher would lay its eggs, build a nest, a floating nest on the sea, and the sea would be calmed by the gods of the wind until the chicks hatched. And it just kind of ensured days of serenity and calm. And I just think that's utterly beautiful. So that's one of my favourites. I also love the words that wear their hearts on their sleeves. So words like, I don't know, secretary, who were keepers of secrets in the old days. They were secretaries. Kids love that one. And licking something into shape is another real favourite of mine, because that goes back to another belief that persisted for centuries, that bear cubs are born as blobs, formless blobs, and then have to be licked into shape by their mums, which is just gorgeous, isn't it? And oh, there's so many sort of metaphors that, you know, actually go back to real beliefs, whether in ancient times or, you know, ones that went up right to Shakespeare's day. A swan song was another one. It was believed that swans were mute all their lives and then suddenly would break into mournful song in the hour of their death, which again is quite beautiful.
And as an etymologist, are you allowed to not like any words? So, for example, moist and coin both make me cringe. I don't know why.
Yeah, I'm with you with moist, as is, I think, the rest of the nation. So I've kind of decided I have to get over the M word because just, you know, it's too common now. Everyone hates it. There's been research done on that again, and it's all about, you know, psychological associations. I always put it together with gusset, or rather I don't put it together with gusset, but gusset is another I hate. Coin, I don't mind, actually. Flange, I don't like. Scrofulous, which was just, scrofula was an old word for a kind of lymphatic disorder. So, I mean, it is all about associations. But then, as we all know, you know, there are words that could be quite beautiful, like bellicose actually means warlike, whereas pulchritudinous means beautiful. So there are ones that just do not go with their meanings at all. But for most most cases, I think it is all about our psychological associations, just as we love certain first names and hate others because of people we've met.
Being a word detective, you know, the way you describe the stories behind the words is just amazing. And it's something that you're doing very, very nicely on your podcast series with Giles Brandreth, who I absolutely love. Tell us a bit about Something Rhymes with Purple and what inspired it.
Well, Giles inspired it. I had thought, oh, it would be really nice to do a podcast, but, you know, there are other ones out there. And I think I was just a bit defeatist about it and assumed that it was too late. And then Giles, whom I've worked with for many years on Countdown, I think he's probably had more appearances than anyone else sitting next to whoever the lexicographer was in Dictionary Corner for years. He just said, you know, I'd love to do a podcast and I'd love to do it with you. And Giles being Giles, who is genuinely the most prolific worker I have ever met. I mean, he just never stops. But as he himself will say, he is defined by his work. It's, you know, it's a joy. We went into the offices of Something Else, a production company, and I thought we were there for a preliminary discussion. But instead he said, right, we're going to do 4 test pilots, see how it goes, and then we'll take it from there. So I was like, okay. But I'm so glad. It's a bit like that Countdown decision of my boss. I'm so glad that I went with it because it's just been a joy, a very different experience. I think the best description of podcasting that I've heard is that it's like sitting in a studio, a radio studio, about to broadcast, but the red light hasn't come on yet. So it's that kind of pre-record type of conversation where you're just being very unstructured, very open, very honest, and just chatting in a very kind of conversational rather than more formalized way, I suppose. And it is quite irreverent. It goes in all sorts of strange places. Giles can be quite naughty. He also name drops like mad, which I tease him about, but he seems to have met every single person on the planet. Well, you know, that's a terrible use of hyperbole, but he genuinely does know so many people and has wonderful theatrical anecdotes as well. So he does all of that and keeps me to a thread of that kind of word detection, where words come from. But it's meandering, it's fun. I learn a lot. I hope he learns a lot. And it works. We're two very, very different people, but we really enjoy it. And actually, the intimacy has got greater, I think, during lockdown. We're obviously set up in our little makeshift home studios. We're looking at each other on Zoom, but somehow it feels more direct than doing it in my kitchen, which is where we often record, where you have, you know, Lawrence, our lovely producer, sitting there and you've got all the tech. It somehow feels much more direct to do it via computer. And that was very surprising, but I do love it.
I love the way he wheedles things out of you. And one lovely example of that when I was listening in the kitchen yesterday was you were talking about Sauterne, I think, and the first time you'd had it. And you said to him, oh, I can't repeat this on the podcast, but something dreadful happened the first time I had any. And he said to you something like, oh, don't worry, Susie, it's only me and you. Nobody's really listening, despite the fact you've had 2 million downloads for your podcast series so far. So you were meant to tell that story, which I'm going to try and encourage you to tell now when you're at a dinner party.
It's very strange. For everything I've just said, that it's much more intimate and direct. There are points where I think I must ask Lawrence to edit that out at the end. But this one we didn't edit out. And it was just, I don't know, it was just one of those episodes that I'll never forget. It was a friend of mine, Mark. His dad was, I think he was sheriff of Oxfordshire. So it was, which is a kind of odd title anyway, but they were a lovely family and they really looked after me when I was a student and they lived quite close to Oxford. So I would go out there to kind of, you know, escape if I needed escaping from kind of studenthood. And it was quite a formal dinner. So he had various officials representing the county. And I was sitting next to a judge, actually, who, thank goodness, turned out to be a really lovely judge. I had dressed up, but I was on a student budget. So I could, in those days, shoulder pads were the thing. At least I thought they were. They probably, even then, it was probably really old-fashioned.
No, they were. They were the things, Susie. Okay, they were. Good. I wore plenty of those.
Good. So I couldn't afford anything that had real shoulder pads in them, clearly. So I put on this kind of satin black jacket with just enough. The cleavage wasn't too awful, but I decided to stuff some little padded things under my bra straps in order to kind of puff up my shoulders a little bit. And anyway, we were enjoying soup. I was chatting away to this judge. And then the inevitable happened, which is one of the shoulder pads just plopped onto my soup, splashed onto his tie, not the pad, but the soup. And he very sweetly helped me retrieve it and wrap it in a napkin. But yeah, it's funny because I had not remembered that episode. I'd repressed it entirely until Giles brought it up the other day. I'm like, yeah.
And then you're right,
we were
drinking
so tanned. No, it's fine. I think I'm over it now. It's like the M word. I'm over it now.
You're also helping the nation with our spelling, aren't you? Just as well as everything else that you fit into your life.
Yes, I've come to work on a really lovely app, which is called Sirlinkalot, and it's been created by Andy Salmon, aka Sirlinkalot, because his mind literally just works in linking things together. And it's really lovely because the English is, the adjective I always use with English spelling is gnarly. It's the gnarliest language there is really when it comes to spelling, and everyone who's tried to learn themselves or has tried to teach kids will know there are so many exceptions. There are no rules. We talk about the I before E except after C rule, but that's rubbish. There are more exceptions to the rules than there are ones that abide by it. And there are only a certain number of words that can be spelled phonically and phonetically as well. So we're left with this huge tranche of words that actually you just have to learn off by heart. And what Sirlinkalot does is come along with really sweet, funny animations and helps break down a word and kind of lodge its spelling in your memory through these clever animations and linking, basically. And it's just really fun. And I think part of the reason I love it is just the feedback we've had, particularly from kids and adults, actually, who have dyslexia or who have really struggled with it and just assumed that they'll never be able to manage it. It's just been genuinely heartwarming. It's just been really lovely. So we decided to offer it free during lockdown. And, you know, I think, as you say, everyone needs a bit of help at the moment, and particularly with spelling. And it's just a lovely, fun, sweet thing. And I come in and do Susie's story. So I will tell you the story of secretary, for example, or I might tell you that a freelancer, which is not too difficult to spell, but it used to be a knight who was free to use his lance for anyone who paid him. So I come in with some of the stories and hopefully will help again, just sort of back up why a word is spelled that way, probably because it came from another country.
I could listen to your stories all day, Susie, but just leave us, if you would, with a word that perhaps we can all try and get into our conversation today.
I'll give you one that I tweeted recently, actually, because for me, it just fits so many categories and so many characters, including me on occasion. It's from the 16th century, so it's pretty old, and it's a mumpsimus. We all know a mumpsimus. If you need the plural, it's mumpsimuses. And essentially, these are people who insist that they're right, despite clear evidence that they are wrong.
Fantastic. What a great word to get in. Susie, it's been brilliant to chat to you. I hope you felt today that we haven't pressed record. It's felt like a really lovely chat. And I'm so grateful for you doing it.
It has. And I apologise if on any occasion I'm inarticulate. I always feel the pressure because people assume that there'll be no white noise when I speak at all. But as you can see, I'm as fallible as anyone.
There was no white noise to me. Well, that was etymologist Susie Dent sharing her love of words with us. Do have a listen to Susie's Something Rhymes with Purple podcast with Giles Brandreth. And of course, you can always find her in Dictionary Corner in search of those nine-letter words. I'll be back next week with another edition of the Convex Conversation. We're on Spotify, Google and Apple Podcasts, and at convex.podbean.com. So do feel free to share the series with your friends. Thanks for listening. See you soon.